Here's my plan for the day. I'm going to just say a little bit about what is the crisis that has got me thinking about these questions. What is the kind of key question that's sort of driving me in the project? I'm going to say a little bit about learning from history. I find that when I'm trying to puzzle through a hard problem, that I find myself going back to try and see how people have tried to solve these problems in the past, to see both why they landed on the solutions that they did and gave us the law that we have, which sometimes seems really inadequate to solving the problem. And also just to see how they're thinking through many of the same problems that we're struggling with. And I'm gonna say just 2 seconds of what the kind of key rules of modern international humanitarian law is that this process gave us. And then a bit of the post 9/11 and the new unraveling of these rules, and which has given us, you know, the crisis that we're facing today. And then a bit about why I think it's especially important now to be thinking about these questions, why it's especially urgent at this moment. And a few words about what we can do. To be honest, this is the least well-formed part of my thinking and would be eager for your feedback on kind of what can we do about these problems. I'm much better at sort of figuring out what the problem is. So far, I'm having a harder time figuring out what the solution is. Okay, so first the crisis. I mean, this is no surprise to all of you. Not that far from here, civilians are being killed in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Of course, many combatants are being killed as well. But we see every day stories about hospitals and schools and transportation and, you know, various civilians being killed in the course of the conflict in Ukraine. You also can't open a newspaper or open a news website without seeing the latest toll of the war in Gaza. And many of the recent casualties in the war, at least according to one account, are mostly civilians. There's no doubt that lots of civilians are being killed and suffering in the course of that war. And Sudan, which we tend to talk less about, but where the horrors continue to unfold, their latest news, which is not reflected here, the fall of al-Fashir and what seems to be slaughter of civilians is taking place. We don't have as much news about that as we do about some conflicts, but it's clear civilians, again, are caught in the crossfire of the conflict. And so this leads me to a question, which may seem a bit naive, but I think is nonetheless, hopefully, one that's worth getting a project going, which is just, if the key goal of international humanitarian law is to protect civilians from the worst violence of war, why are so many civilians dying, being injured, and suffering in the course of all of these wars? Now, if the promise of international humanitarian law is to protect civilians, why is it apparently failing at that task? So I've begun in my thinking about this project. So as was mentioned, I'm in Berlin this fall, the American Academy in Berlin, and it's been a wonderful place to sort of step back a bit and try to think a kind of big picture about what's going on. And I've started by kind of trying to go back into history and sort of see, when did we first start getting rules regulating war, and why did they take the shape that they did? So I often start with Theo Grotius. If you've read my book, The Internationalist, you see we started with Theo Grotius there, often known as the father of international law. And he wrote in 1625, as we again spoke about, by we, I mean me and my colleague Scott Shapiro, who was my co-author in that book, about the way in which he had an idea of just war. But his theory of just war is very different from what we would think of as just war today. In his view, a just war was any war that was fought for a just cause, which was basically any kind of claim that a state could make that there had been wrongdoing against it. And so there's a whole host of reasons that are appropriate in this kind of view of just war. And he, what we didn't speak as much about in the book, in The Internationalist, was his views about what you could do in pursuing this just war. And he essentially has very few limits on a just war. There's effectively no real limit. So he says the right to kill extends to infants and women. How far this right is to inflict injury extends may be perceived from the fact that the slaughter even of infants and women is made with impunity. So if a state is fighting a just war, it's fighting to obtain its legal rights, to right a wrong, it effectively can do more or less anything necessary to win that fight. There are a few little limitations he sort of pulls out of thin air. No poisoning, no killing by treachery, and no rape. The first two were mostly because kings didn't particularly like being poisoned or killed by treachery, and they were the most likely to be subject to that kind of killing. And so they essentially kind of agreed as a matter of custom to avoid using that as a method of war. Rape, he has an explanation that honestly I don't entirely understand why he singles that out as a particular violation. Not everyone at that period did. But those are essentially the only limits that he would put in place. I've become fascinated by the 30 Years' War, partially because it happened in Germany where I'm staying, but also because it is a war that's waged by rulers that have been reading Hugo Grotius's work. So this guy is Gustavus Adolphus, who was the king of Sweden. He joins the 30 Years' War kind of in the midst of the war. And he's a particularly compelling figure for me, in part because he's known as sort of one of the first modernizers of war. He innovated all kinds of new techniques. He innovated new kinds of weapons of war. He came up with the idea of organizing his troops so that they, you know, when one is shooting, there's, you know, a set behind them. Anyway, he had all kinds of various techniques of war. He also tried to humanize war. He had his own articles of war that he issued, which looked a lot like the Liber Code, interestingly, almost the same length. But the content was somewhat different. He said things like, you can't pillage unless I order you to. You can't kill women and children unless you're ordered to. You can't, there's all these like prohibitions, but they're all prohibitions on doing these things unilaterally and making choices for troops making the choices on their own. He's also especially interesting because he develops these laws of war against this backdrop of Hugo Grotius's work, and he's said to have slept during his time fighting the 30 Years' War with a Bible and Hugo Grotius's Law of War and Peace under his pillow. Whether it's true or not, we don't know. But he clearly was heavily influenced by Hugo Grotius's thinking, and the fact that he waged the war in the way that he did, and he had a set of rules that were very constraining for their time, but also, you know, made clear that these were not absolute prohibitions. These were prohibitions only as long as he hadn't ordered these kinds of acts to take place, that you could effectively kill pretty much anyone, pillage, take things from local population, but only if he said that you could. This makes some sense because at the time, the way that armies were organized was much more decentralized. There was no kind of central public army. He was sort of one of the first to put in place this idea of conscription of civilians within the state. So he had conscripted numbers of Swedes to join this fight. And at the very beginning of the war, when he first entered it, a high percentage of his troops were actually citizen soldiers, which was unusual for the time. But as the war went on, he became more and more like everyone else, which is he just added on more and more local troops. There was also lots of Scottish troops that joined, mercenary troops. Most of these were very local, disorganized, decentralized troops that effectively there was a local leader who was willing to join sides. He would sort of raise up his own little army and pledge it to support one side or the other. And in return, he would get often pillage to feed his troops, and he would get some promise of land at the end of the whole thing. There was no kind of like central organization of armed forces in the way that there are today. And so it makes sense that Adolphus was so focused on this idea of preventing the forces from unilaterally resorting to force. And that was really his central focus at the time. And that was extremely difficult to do. I mean, he was the only one who really tried to do it at the time, even that modest limits that he was trying to put in place. Now that all begins to change in the mid to late 1600s up through the 1700s, standing armies become commonplace. Whereas they hadn't really existed in kind of early 1600s, so there was very limited kind of nascent ideas of a standing army. By the mid 1700s, you know, as is reflected in this quote from Adam Smith, basically it had become conventional wisdom that any significant state needed to have a standing army. They now had the capacity to have a bureaucracy, they could collect taxes, they could have a command and control structure. There was just the mechanism of the state that enabled them to regulate and manage the forces in a way that just wasn't possible really when you were having this very decentralized military that you're organizing. So now these are all citizen soldiers. Conscription becomes much more the order of the day. There's a hierarchy. People are in for a period of time and then often do leave, particularly conscripted soldiers. So there's a much more kind of formalized system that's put in place over the course of that period. And what I am thinking about, the idea that I have, is that creation of this sort of military class and conscription and militaries creates the possibility of the opposite, really, in a way, for the first time. That you have this group of people whose job it is to fight the wars, and we can organize them. There's a command and control structure. They get uniforms for the first time. They're centrally provisioned for the first time. They get food and weapons and everything from the center in a way that wasn't true early on. And then that creates a kind of possibility of an opposite, which is a group of people who are not that, who are not part of the war. And so the idea that I'm imagining is this kind of idea of an invention of the civilian. The word civilian actually doesn't even really exist in the English language or isn't really used commonly until late 1800s, early 1900s. Earlier on, it's used, but only to mean those who are enforcing civil law. So not in the way that we think of the term civilian today. So this is reflected in, among other writings of the time, in Vattel's work, The Law of Nations, where he sounds very different from Grotius, right? He's sounding very different from Grotius here. Women, children, feeble old men, sick persons come under the description of enemies. So they are enemies. But these enemies who make no resistance and consequently have no right to maltreat their persons or use any violence against them, much less to take away their lives. So it seems like there's something of a shift that's taking place from Grotius to Vattel. And I think that's partially reflecting a change in the organization of armies and the capacity to actually instill some kind of control in the military forces. I'm sure if you have studied international humanitarian law, you've heard of this sort of like momentous moment in the history of international humanitarian law, of the Battle of Solferino. Henri Dunant witnesses the aftermath of the battle. He writes this book that A Memory from Solferino, which describes the battle in really like great detail, very exciting. Turns out he didn't actually see the battle at all. Which he kind of had to admit later on. But he did see the aftermath. He, in fact, was there and was horrified by what he saw. I mean, people dying on the battlefield for lack of water and food, you know, all these young men who had been horrifically harmed in the war and who were not receiving any kind of medical support, much less like basic needs that they have. And some of them died on the battlefield, not from their wounds, but from lack of adequate water and food. They were just left there for 4 or 5 days and perished as a result. So he's horrified. He comes back. He writes this very powerful account of what he had seen. Notice here this picture. I don't know how well you can see it. Certainly in the back, you're going to have a hard time seeing it. But this is a war that was fought literally on a battlefield. These were huge troops that were meeting hundreds of thousands, 100,000 on either side, more than 100,000 on either side, massive deaths and violence that had taken place. This is what a standing army can do. It's very organized. You have these like nice rows of tents, but you also have far more people fighting than you've ever had before. They're far better at delivering violence, but they're generally delivering it against one another. Civilians are largely left out of it. So this is another aspect that sort of reflects the shift that's taken place in war. Instead of building your soldiers with private people, you know, it traditionally under the Gustavus Adolphus's time, they would basically have the soldiers kind of living in people's homes and taking their food in order to survive. By the time you get to the mid 1800s in this battle, you're you have, you know, provisioning, you have these well-organized camps, you have tents, you have all these central provisions, but you haven't yet come up with any set of rules to manage the infliction of violence and to care for these citizen soldiers who have put their lives on the line. And the horror that emerged from this account leads to the first Geneva Convention of 1864, which is first major multilateral international convention attempting to manage the violence of war. And I think it somewhat reflects the moment that we're in, because you've got these states that are able to raise these very large citizen armies. But these very large citizen armies they're made up of civilians. So they're made up of citizens. And states recognize that if they're not adequately caring for their soldiers, it's very different from a time when they were, you know, the Swedish king had a bunch of German mercenaries working for him. He didn't much care for them. You know, he didn't care all that much what happened to them. But if you're in a situation where it's your own citizens who are fighting and dying and who are being left wounded on the battlefield, it's a different story. And so the Geneva Convention is really focused on this question of providing for wounded soldiers, because that was what the story that had been told all around Europe reflected. But it begins this process of thinking about how to regulate war centrally, and states being willing to bind themselves to some set of shared principles. And in that sense, it was pretty revolutionary. Another key moment in the development of early international humanitarian law is the Brussels Declaration. Martens, who, if you study IHL, know from the Martens Clause, he was the sort of a young, 28 years old when the conference starts. He's a young professor of international law, also working in the foreign ministry in Russia. Russia is the one who calls the convention. Interestingly, I hadn't quite realized how active Russia was in this period and sort of really getting the conversation going around limiting the means and methods of war. They're the ones who are calling these conventions, who are bringing states together. And some of it, yes, is because there is a lot of fast development of armament at this time. And Russia is concerned about keeping up. And it's very expensive to constantly be updating these weapons. And, you know, this convention, at least one of the concerns was there were new kind of repeater guns that were being developed. And they recognized that it was going to cost them millions of dollars to actually keep up and replace the weapons that are providing to their troops with the kind of latest technology. And so they had an interest in trying to limit armament. So there's obviously self-interest in that respect. But that part of the conference actually really never got off the ground. And what did get off the ground was some regulation, some agreement to limit the means and methods of war. So they agree on some things that, from our modern perspective, don't seem all. You can't do anything you want. They developed this idea of fortified places and undefended or defended and undefended cities. It's a kind of rough way, I think, of trying to get at protecting civilians. So the defended cities were fair game. You could bombard them, you could attack them, you could do what was necessary to defeat them. But open cities, you were supposed to leave alone. That's the idea that is developed in the Brussels Declaration and actually becomes customary international law. And they also are supposed to try and spare, you know, significant public goods. Buildings dedicated to art, science, or charitable purposes, and hospitals. So they're already thinking at this early stage of trying to preserve some of the things that are especially important to civilian life. And they prohibit pillage, which is really one of the things that harmed civilians most in war, because it wasn't just the violence that was visited on them during the course of pillage, but it was also most peasants at this time are sort of living on the edge. And if a soldier comes along and takes all the food that you have, you starve. And so preventing pillage is a really important way of limiting the harm that's done to civilians in the course of war. Now, Martin thought this was a total failure. And the reason he thought it was a total failure is because they came up with these great rules, that everybody signed it at the conference, then they went home and nobody ratified it. Nobody agreed to adopt these as binding rules. And he felt like it would just have been a total travesty and would waste of time. And in a way it was, but I actually think my perspective is that it wasn't, because all these ideas are ideas that eventually find their way into customary international law and into subsequent treaties and shape for the first time this idea that we need to adopt some limitations on war to protect civilians. And we might even have to adopt protections for civilians that might make it a little bit harder for us to fight, and that's okay. This is really a novel idea at the time. And for that, I think that those who are participating in the conference deserve a lot of credit. This idea is then expanded and finally adopted as a binding agreement about a quarter century later in the Hague conferences. So in 1899, and then again in 1907, much more expansive and binding obligations are adopted. And much of it picking up on the language, almost verbatim, from the Brussels Declaration. So while it didn't work in the Brussels Declaration, it wasn't adopted as binding, it was later many of these ideas become the kind of core starting point for the Hague conferences, where these rules are adopted as binding. But then there's a development that kind of throws everything out of whack, and that is the invention of the airplane. The airplane is invented in 1903, and then by 1911, Italians are using them to drop bombs. So this guy, Giulio Gavotti, was a soldier in the Italian army, and he wrote this very stirring letter back to his father about the first mission to drop bombs from an airplane. He was the first one to do it. They had tried doing this a little bit from hot air balloons, but hot air balloons don't make a fast escape. So that's a downside of dropping bombs from an air balloon. And they kind of are subject to the whims of where the air is going, right? And they get blown off course all the time. Generally, these hot air balloons were more deadly to the people in them than they were to people on the ground. So the idea of dropping bombs from an airplane actually is a real innovation in technology. And it scrambles everything. You know, he writes a story about he takes off in this plane. He has these little basically grenades in a box next to him that he has to pull out, and he has to pull a pin out of them while he's steering the plane. And they have to hold it, hold a latch on it so it doesn't explode in the plane. And they have to throw it out by hand. He throws this out. He hits some Ottoman forces that were gathered at a point place outside of Tripoli. This was during the war between Italy and modern day what is now Libya. Came back very excited. This was celebrated all over Europe. The Ottomans, of course, were much less excited about this. In what feels like a kind of moment of ought to have brought some reflection, but didn't, the Ottomans protested that at least one of the bombs landed on the hospital. Unfortunately, passes prologue. Now, what happens with airplanes is that it just shifts the terms of war in a completely different way, right? You don't have the kind of battlefield in the same way. You don't have forces. The front line loses a lot of meaning because now you can project force far behind the front line using airplanes. That some of them can travel hundreds of miles and drop a bomb far inland from where the actual fighting is happening. You can hit supply routes. You can hit forces that are gathering far beyond the battlefield. And it also creates incentives to hide and often to hide in civilian buildings. There, I don't have the slide of this, but I came across another set of interesting slides during the Italo-Ethiopian War on the eve of World War II, where the Italians were accusing the Ethiopians of using Red Cross hospitals as shelter for troops, and had all this propaganda that Ethiopia was using hospitals to hide their forces. They may very well have been doing so. In fact, chances are good that they were, because you're not going to stand in the open waiting to be bombed, right? I mean, that would be kind of stupid, especially in this case where Italy was dropping mustard gas from these airplanes. And so it's natural that they would try to find a place to hide from these horrors. But then it makes the idea of trying to differentiate between the civilian and the combatant almost impossible, which is the same problem we're, of course, dealing with today in different form. They tried to do something about this in 1923. They come up with these Hague rules on aerial warfare. This is where they invent a lot of ideas that we see today in modern international humanitarian law. A lot of the terms that we use today, it's the first time, as far as I can tell, that these terms were used in international documents. So they abandoned this whole idea of defended, undefended cities, because they realized an airplane kind of scrambles that. If you have your own forces nearby and you can defend a city, does that make the city defended even though it has no fortifications? Yes, probably. So then every city is defended if you have an air force. So they gave up on that. And they adopt for the first time this idea of military objectives as lawful targets, which is still the language that we use today, military objective as opposed to civilian and civilian object. So military objective is an object that is considered to be a lawful target under modern international humanitarian law. And then invent for the first time this idea of collateral damage or proportionality, which again is one of these core ideas of modern international law. And this is sort of the way in which they phrase it. And what I find interesting is they talk about limiting violence unless it's sufficiently important. So again, it is a suggestion that even useful violence is going to be prohibited unless it's sufficiently important. And again, that's an idea that we see in modern international humanitarian law. So the first time we kind of see the invention of these ideas is to try to respond to the airplane. Yet again, they come up with these lovely rules. Everybody who's at the conference signs the agreement, and then yet again, nobody ratifies them. So it doesn't actually become law, though it does shape very much customary international law and becomes, as I said, kind of the starting point for a lot of the rules that later follow. Now, I'm not going to go through the full history, and I'm still myself working through archival materials from the Geneva Conventions, and I haven't even made my way to the additional protocols. But let me just say a few of the kind of key rules that this process has given us. So we have this idea of a principle of distinction between civilians and combatants, which I think didn't exist in the 1600s, certainly. It was the only beginning kind of the idea that we could have a distinction between these two things only really emerges in the kind of 1700s or thereabouts. This idea of proportionality, which is this idea that an attack shouldn't lead to excessive civilian, even if you're aiming at a military objective, even if your objective is a lawful one, you nonetheless should limit your use of force if it's going to be excessively harmful towards civilians. And that's an idea I think really emerges in 1923. There's little glimmers of it earlier on, but I think really 1923 is kind of the key moment to really see that, and it's now incorporated into additional Protocol 1 and customary international law. And this idea of precaution, that parties to the conflict must take all feasible precautions to protect the civilian population and civilian objects under their control against the effect of attacks. And this is considered customary international law today, and you see glimmers of these ideas earlier on. But of course, as I started, we're at a moment where it seems like the promise of these rules, at least, is not being perfectly met. So why might that be? And this is, again, speculative, and this is early on in the project. I haven't started writing these chapters yet, so this is where I think I'm going. But I very much welcome feedback if people have thoughts that either support or run contrary to these thoughts. So, of course, the 9/11 attacks are horrific. And nearly 3,000 civilians are killed in the course of a day. And it really shifts the United States posture towards the world in a pretty fundamental way and ignites a series of conflicts that continue today. U.S. counterterrorism operations are really expansive. Of course, there's drone operations. I don't know if you can see this map very well, but it shows basically all the various places where the U.S. is engaged in some form of counterterrorism operations. This is from Brown University. Some of it is drone operations, but there's a lot of like counterterrorism training and support and assistance to states around the world. And this doesn't even show kind of covert operations or small footprint operations that are taking place. So the U.S. launches a pretty capacious war, sometimes referred to as a forever war, with significant use of U.S. military force, particularly throughout the Middle East. The kind of conflict that really expands significantly is what we will refer to, what has sometimes been referred to as internationalized interstate wars. This is from the Uppsala Project data. And you see that the number of wars where states are involved in civil war. So there's an intrastate war, war between non-state actors, or between non-state actor and the state, and then an outside state getting involved in that is really kind of where we've seen significant growth in the forms of conflict that are taking place. And then the process of waging these conflicts, many of which are the US and US partners who are participating in these conflicts, part of what has happened is an interpretation of kind of the protective principles of international humanitarian law in a way that aims to expand the scope of vulnerability of civilians, or the scope of people who are considered to be targetable civilians, another way to put it. So this is, I have this piece that's about to come out called Crowdsourced War, which includes some of this work. But the idea is, the question is, how closely does an act have to be linked to a harmful act to qualify as directly participating in hostilities? The ICRC's view is a kind of more narrow view that it has to be within one causal step. And so it has to be, don't have to be the one who's actually using violence, but you have to be kind of just one step away from the person who's actually using violence to sort of fit within this idea of a civilian directly participating in hostilities who's therefore targetable and detainable. So the kinds of things that the ICRC would consider counts as combat with enemy forces, obviously that's within one step. Operating anti-aircraft weapons, of course, that's within one step. Real-time spotting of aerial warfare, aerial fire, so spotting that, this is a target or this is a source of threats that we should be, aiming at and trying to destroy. Providing coordinates for immediate strikes, those kinds of things. So very directly connected to the violence or the actual use of violence itself. Whereas the US and some other states, UK is included here, have adopted a broader understanding of what counts as civilians directly participating in hostilities. So things like weapons repairs, transporting fighters, military recruitment, intelligence gathering near operations, even if not directly related to enabling a particular operation, kind of counts or has been treated as counting by the U.S. and a few others who adopt this kind of more capacious view of what are civilians directly participating in hostilities. So this allows for targeting more civilians as a result. Another difference in the kind of what in this article Crowdsourced War that I'm drawing on in the book, the narrow view and the broader view is whether you are continuously targetable or not. So under the ICRC's view, you're targetable while you're directly participating, but not when you're not. And so you can go in and out of status. This is sometimes derogatively referred to as a revolving door. But what it means is you can participate in conflict and then come back and live a civilian life and then, and not be targetable while you're living civilian life. Whereas the US position is like, once the pattern of act begins, you're targetable until you affirmatively disengage. Exactly what you can do to affirmatively disengage is not entirely clear. How do you signal to the drones that you've affirmatively disengaged? Little difficult to know. So these are just a couple of examples, and there are more in the Crowdsourced War article. The main point is just to say that there's a much broader set of civilians who are now targetable. And the problem today is that these sets of rules, this capacious understanding of what are civilians directly participating in hostilities that was developed for the counterterrorism operations are now creating a whole host of problems for civilians in conflict and making a lot more civilians potentially targetable. So this is an app that you can download right now if you want to, although I think you have to read Ukrainian to be able to actually read it, but it's called the EPPO app, or referred to as the EPPO app. And if you download it, it allows you, and there's several of these apps in Ukraine, so this is not the only one. You can use it to take pictures of Russian forces. If you're just an ordinary civilian, take pictures of Russian forces and upload it to the Ukrainian military. You can even take pictures of like a missile in that you see overhead. You can take a picture of it, upload it. And there have been instances where apparently, I find this hard to believe, but it's claimed that those have been intercepted based on these civilian reported, these civilian images have been uploaded to the military. So ordinary civilians walking around with just an ordinary phone now are potentially engaged in intelligence collection. And not only they, so while they're taking the picture, even the ICRC and uploading it, even the ICRC would say you're directly participating because that's sort of direct actionable intelligence that you're providing. But what about when you go home and have dinner with your family and, you know, or what if you delete the app? Well, you could always download the app again. So that doesn't necessarily represent kind of clear disengagement. So the worry is that civilians are, in fact, by virtue of these broader interpretations of civilians who are participating in hostilities, ordinary Ukrainians, many, if not most, ordinary Ukrainians are potentially targetable. As a result of these broader interpretations that we have under international humanitarian law. Under this broad approach to the participating in the IT army, which any of you can do, you don't apparently have to be a cyber expert to participate in the IT army. You just have to be willing to hand over your computer not physically hand it over, but allow them to use it to conduct DDoS attacks. So you sign up, you click a button on the internet, it's very easy, and your computer sort of joins the IT army in attacking Russian government websites. Also some Russian business websites that are affiliated with the leadership in Russia. And again, you know, this is potentially puts you in to this broader definition of civilian structures participating in hostilities, potentially puts you in that broader scope, because you are directly participating in attacks on the Russian government. Under the broad approach, donating to support Ukrainian military effort may be thought to be civilian directly participating in hostilities. So, I mean, if you follow Ukrainian accounts online, I follow a lot of Ukrainian accounts on both Blue Sky and Twitter, you will inevitably see somebody's fundraising pleas. So this is one of them, just from one of the accounts that I follow. Asking for money for Starlink and winter gear. This is military gear, and the Starlinks, of course, are being used as a main way of using for interception of drones and running Ukrainian drones for all the needs that they have on the front for internet access. And then winter gear, even from the very beginning, I talked to some Ukrainians. You know, when they first were conscripting ordinary Ukrainians, people often didn't have like basic gear. They didn't have the boots that they needed. They didn't have uniforms and the like. So there was a lot of crowd fundraising that was done to support the Ukrainian military. And that continues even today. But does providing money for these military purposes potentially put you at risk? Certainly, if you were providing this kind of money to a member of Al-Qaeda, the U.S. would consider you to be civilian directly participating in hostilities. And the broad approach, and this is maybe a little bit more of a reach, but maybe even Elon Musk would be regarding this directly participating in hostilities because of his role in directing and enabling the deployment of Starlink, which, as I mentioned, has been really sometimes referred to as a lifeblood of the Ukrainian military. It is the way in which they're able to operate. And Musk clearly has the capacity to make personal decisions about where it is deployed and where it isn't deployed. He made the decision famously not to activate it over Crimea because he was concerned that it was going to be used to attack what he apparently seems to think is Russian military installations there. So we have the capacity to make these very individual decisions about where to deploy Starlink and where not to. There's a separate set of issues around dual-use objects, which is another way in which the sort of vulnerability of civilians has expanded in the last 20 years or so. And this is a separate larger article that I have called The Rise of Dual-Use Objects that I wrote with Mara Revkin and Asmat Khan. Asmat Khan, you may recognize her name from the New York Times. She wrote the Civilian Casualty Files series, and we used a lot of the work from her FOIA request and lawsuit against the US government to get civilian casualty reports. And then we looked at all these reports and what it was the US government was targeting and when it was that they were targeting what we would consider to be dual use objects and what the civilian impact was of that. And what we see is that a pretty significant willingness to target dual use objects, that is, objects that have both military and civilian uses. These are under kind of international humanitarian law, military objectives. They are within the sort of targetable categories, they're military objectives. But often they're also things that just are really critical to civilian life. And the destruction of them really has a massive impact on the capacity of civilians to live a normal life. The US, along with the UK, has played a critical role in increasing the targeting of civilian objects. So just take transportation infrastructure. This is one of these declassified civilian casualty reports that was provided to Asmat that goes over the Hamra Nasser bridge strike in Mosul. You may know Mosul is a city that has a river that runs through the middle of it and had five bridges, all of which were destroyed in the course of the fighting. And it's not just about the harm that's done to civilians who might be on the bridge at the time that it's targeted, but each bridge that's eliminated, particularly the last one, closes people off from the capacity to reach family, reach their jobs, get access to food. It really has a massive impact on civilian life. And of course, Russia has been targeting transportation from the very beginning of the invasion of Ukraine, famously hitting train stations, buses, and other civilian infrastructure. Electrical infrastructure, Russia has been targeting the electrical infrastructure from the very beginning of this conflict, and the US has called it out as a war crime. But the DoD Law of War Manual says that electrical generation plants are lawful military targets, and the US has treated them as such. And this is a report from Air Wars, which is an NGO that claimed that there was a targeting of an electrical generating facility that led to civilian casualties directly. But the loss of access, it's not just the civilians who were killed in the course of the strike, but it's a loss of access to electricity for the community that matters. Lots of access to refrigeration, lots of access to cooling and places that can get 120 degrees during the day, right? It's lots of access of electricity for hospitals. I mean, it's all the things that people depend on for their lives. Schools, of course, have been in the crosshairs in many cases because they are either alleged to be used or in fact used by combatants for storing weapons or for putting headquarters and the like. So they are lawful military objectives, assuming that those claims are true, but the effect is loss of access to buildings necessary to educate children. And that has been, of course, the Gaza war as well. Hospitals, famously, we've all seen the stories about hospitals. Again, not suggesting that these are not being used by militaries. They are, in many cases, in fact, being used for military purposes, and so are lawful military objectives. But the loss of access to these hospitals is devastating for civilian populations, because it's not only the doctors and the patients who are present in those hospitals at the time that they're hit, but it's the loss of access to basic medical care for communities. So the result of all of this, I want to say, is that protection for civilians in war have been eroded to the point that they have begun to threaten to lose all meaning. Okay, so why now and what can we do? Here's where, as I said, I'm not sure I have the most helpful answers just yet, but I'm working on it. So why now? Well, I think this is especially important right now because this is a foreign affairs piece that I wrote in June, arguing that we might be on the cusp of a transformation in the legal order where states are more willing to resort to use of military force against one another. If that's true, and if that does actually happen, then we're gonna see a lot more conflict in our future. Yeah, living in Germany now, Germany has raised the debt cap on military spending because frankly, people are very scared that the war is coming for them. And when I was meeting with some defense military officials, there were Polish defense officials who were with us who were monitoring ongoing drone attacks that were coming into the country. So we're seeing the possibility, at least, of increased violence and an erosion or breakdown of the prohibition on the use of force, which suggests that this problem may not just be limited to the Middle East or to, you know, places far away, but could be coming for us as well. So, and that makes us obviously all the more concerning and something we have to be thinking about. So what can we do? I mean, I think it's obvious that civilians are never gonna be perfectly safe in war. So the best thing to do is prevent war altogether, right? We're never going to put in place rules in cases of violence that are gonna perfectly protect civilians. The only perfect protection from war is to not have a war. But that said, I don't think that should stop us from trying to find ways to regulate war to protect civilians more effectively. And I think that states can and should work to reverse some of the erosion of these legal principles meant to protect civilians. So I would argue that we should push back on the US interpretation of civilians directly participating in hostilities. And reaffirm a kind of narrower view about what is the scope of civilians who are lawful targets in the course of military conflict. States should consider what are sometimes called reverberating effects and cumulative effects when hitting dual-use targets. So reverberating effects are not just the harm to civilians at that moment of the strike, but what is the impact of losing access to electricity for that community? What are the impact of losing access to a hospital for that community? Take that into account in the course of making the judgment as to whether you're inflicting excessive civilian harm in the course of taking a strike. And not only take into account these reverberating effects, but take into account the cumulative effects. Destroying the first hospital is terrible. Destroying the last one is catastrophic. And so understanding the cumulative impact over time is something I think states can and should be doing. And they should try to build robust programs to minimize civilian casualties and to acknowledge and compensate harm to civilians when it happens. The U.S. has a pretty modest civilian compensation scheme, as do most states. Mostly they make them a salatia and ex gratia payments. That is like, we're not admitting we did anything wrong, but here's some money to make you feel a little bit better because, you know, your family member was killed in the strike. We could do more and we could do better. They're very unequal in terms of the amounts that are being provided. It's very unpredictable. People don't know when and how they can get access to this money. It's often done at the commander's choice. And we could have a much more robust system. Now, a worry, of course, is that this might look like paying to kill civilians. And obviously that's a concern. But I think the effect of this could be that it would bring out more information about civilians who, in fact, are being harmed in the course of the conflict. We'd learn a lot more. And we'd have to pay some costs. It's not clear why civilians who are killed in the course of a conflict, whether through no fault of their own, why they should be the ones to bear the costs as opposed to those who decided to use force. And I think states can and should hold one another to account. It's not just the states that are, you know, have these expansive interpretations that are the problem, but obviously the ones that are ignoring the law altogether, which appears to be the case. Well, I don't know if we're ignoring it altogether, but seems to be pretty impervious to critiques of their international humanitarian law violations. That is Russia and other states that seem to not particularly care. States really are the ones who have to enforce the law against one another. Obviously, there's the obligation to do internal investigations and enforce it internally, But states ultimately are the ones with the power to enforce the law against one another.